opinions get passed down to us as advice on how we should navigate our lives. Most shoulds then are based on little more than fear. The same well-intentioned men and women that taught us to believe in God didn't always know how to teach us to truly trust God in bold, peculiar, and brazen ways. They had wounds and worries too. Maybe it seemed easier or wiser for them and us to play it safe and to call that faith. So now our faith wiring has been short-circuited by faulty thinking and hidden fears masquerading as solutions. Not all information about what's appropriate is broken, of course, but it can be tricky to discern the blessed and the bad from the broken. Often we think we're hearing from God, but in reality, opinion, tradition, or ideas of appropriateness are sneaking their way into our heart, mind, and soul. The key to elevating your life is being open to the possibility that some of your steadfast beliefs were built with misinformation, passed down regret, faulty thinking, or a desire to conform. This is a big deal because what we believe makes us who we are. It sets our personal reality. Beliefs either expand or limit our horizons. Our ability to fulfill our purpose begins or ends then with our beliefs. However, God's truth always trumps tradition. We just have to be willing to see old things in a new way and release what God is trying to reinvent. Right now, I want to invite you to open your heart and allow God to show you the rules that have been consciously and unconsciously navigating your life. Remember, there is no self-judgment or criticism here. This is simply a chance to let God speak to you and reveal a few false ideas and truths you've internalized and other rules you've now outgrown. Don't overthink this. Pause and just jot down whatever comes to mind. What are the passed down opinions, traditions, and fears you've adopted that may no longer serve you? Once you identify the belief, pinpoint where it started, and then determine whether it belongs in the blessed, bad, or broken bucket. Now I'd like for you to turn your attention to your PDF materials and look for the graphic that reads, List Your Rules Below. What you're going to do is you're going to identify your rules, your rule makers, and then assign it to the relevant belief bucket. When you identify your rule, you're going to look at what belief you formed associated with it. Next, you're going to jot down your rule maker. That's who wrote it or where you got that rule from. And then finally, you're going to classify it. Does it belong in the blessed bucket, the bad bucket, or the broken bucket? Rule breaking. I bet some of the life choices you've made were because you too were afraid of truly pursuing your passion and failing. I know some of mine were. And each day, I meet women who also pursued a career path because it paid well, or just because it was the natural next step based on the major they chose when they were like 18 years old. They were afraid they would be unable to make a living doing what they truly loved. Maybe they've even forgotten what they once loved. We're taught that getting to love what we do is a luxury, not a necessity for a believer. That's broken thinking, my friend. It's also hard when we see others make what we think are mistakes. We end up vowing to never be like them or do what they did. Sound familiar? Avoiding mistakes isn't necessarily bad, but preventing disaster is not the same as pursuing destiny. There is a very big difference. We're not here to live as others think we should. Though we often become masters at it, life is far too short and precious for conformity. We're here to live a life that glorifies God while defying the impossible and to inspire and invite others to do the very same. That's what it means to live in God's image. Instead of letting a bunch of accumulated broken philosophies from grade school, Sunday school, your mama's kitchen, or childhood determine what constitutes a blessed, appropriate, God-touched life, I'd love for you and God to develop your own unsullied theory. A new level requires fresh thinking. So set aside religion, take off your culture, and disrobe from the conventions and traditions you've learned to wear so well. Purpose can't be written by man. It's not a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. God wants to break up the ingrained belief system blocking what he is ready to build anew in your life. As a woman thinketh, so is she. Thoughts don't just shape our reality, they reveal it. It's manifestation 101. If we think we can, we do. If we think we can't, we don't. The same God that said all things are possible wants his daughters to be fully aware of what we think and why we think it. The limited thinking of yesterday cannot take us into the unlimited realm of tomorrow. Thoughts and beliefs establish who we are and who we have yet to become as well. Purpose and belief go together like seeds and soil. Belief is the soil, and purpose grows out of it. God is seeking to water thoughts that are truly fruitful so that you can live a faith-bearing life overflowing with multifaceted fulfillment. God needs your participation so he can make room for a new thing to blossom and bloom. Chapter 6, Stage 2, Talent. Who did I decide to be? When you don't have a clear vision, any vision will do. In the discovery stage, we were introduced to the rules that govern our behavior. Uncovering your rules, the real captain navigating your life choices, is an ongoing, intentional process of self-awareness. At this point, I hope you are better able to understand why you believe and do the things you do. Stage 2, the talent stage, is where success guides our steps and approval paves our path. This is where we turn our beliefs about where we think we belong into choices that set us on a particular path. The rules have spoken, and we have listened. It's best to play it safe and find a hideout called predictability or success. So we pick a lane, and that lane becomes our life. In our discussion of the discovery stage, we asked, who did the rules say you were supposed to be? In the talent stage, we ask, who did you decide to be? Batons a-knocking. My parents were wonderful about giving my brother and me opportunities to explore our interests and develop our abilities. I was a cheerleader in elementary school and played soccer and softball through junior high. I also picked up the non-traditional sport of baton twirling, as I briefly alluded to earlier. I actually first got into it when I was in daycare. These ladies would come by the daycare a couple of days a week and teach baton twirling lessons. I love looking at pictures from this time. I had big, poofy cotton candy hair with those infamous lilac Coke bottle glasses and would wear a classic 80s white t-shirt with red trim around the collar and sleeves, along with super tiny little red shorts. We even had recitals to showcase all that we'd learned. After I left the daycare and enrolled in elementary school, I practiced baton on my own. Then my mom discovered that a lady at the end of our street, Miss Caffey, taught baton twirling lessons in her garage-turned-dance studio. After about a year, Miss Caffey pulled my mom aside and suggested I find another teacher. I was picking up the tricks and combinations really quickly, much faster than the rest of the kids. She couldn't spend the one-on-one time with me to teach me the more complex, higher-level skills. She also suggested we consider me twirling competitively, but that wasn't her area of expertise. But where exactly does one go to find a competitive baton twirling coach? This sort of thing wasn't really well advertised. Gymnastics and dance, that's pretty easy to find. But twirling, not so much. One day we were in the parking lot of the elementary school I attended. They had a huge covered area in the back of the school where the playgrounds and soccer fields were. But this day, something fascinating was happening. There was a teenage girl there with her mom practicing baton twirling. She was amazing, the best I'd ever seen. She'd throw her baton in the air, spin around 4 or even 5 times, and catch it under her leg or behind her back. She could juggle 2 and 3 batons at the same time as well, and she incorporated dance and acrobatics. I was absolutely mesmerized. My mom and I got out of the car and just watched from the parking lot. We watched her the next few weekends, and then my mom asked whether she would be willing to coach me, and she actually said yes. Her name was Kathy Gilbert, and she was about 15 years old. Get this, she lived on my street, too. Her house was at the opposite end of the block from Miss Kathy. I had never seen her outside playing. Now I knew why. She was always practicing. Her house was filled with trophies. They took up the entire living room and entry hall of their home, and many were taller than me. I wanted to be like her. I wanted to keep getting better so I could win some trophies like those, too. However, one day Kathy also said it would be best if I started working with a more advanced coach, her coach. And that's how I almost met Janice Jackson. I say almost because you didn't just automatically get to work with Janice Jackson. You had to audition. She didn't teach fundamentals. You had to be competition ready. So I tried out with a woman named Susan. She was a twirling and dance instructor at Janice's internationally renowned Dao Star Studio. She had been on one of Janice's world champion teams when she was my age. I noticed her in the team portraits hanging next to the massive international trophies in the studio lobby every time I walked in. I would be in very good hands. They made champions here. The studio accepted me as a student, but I would have to master more fundamentals, my technique, my skill set, and my dance abilities before I could take private lessons. I worked hard. I'm thankful for Susan and how patient she was in getting me ready to move on up. When I started training with Janice, my life, even as a young teenager, went to a whole different level. Twirling competitively gave me an escape from the low expectations of my school teachers. I was surrounded by people who actually believed in my potential. Other than my parents, I'd never really experienced that before. And although there wasn't much ethnic diversity in the sport, I don't remember seeing very many black girls, Janice and her staff never once treated me like I was different. That, too, was a first. That studio was like a church for me. It was a place where possibility and hard work intersected to ignite new horizons. I kept competing and eventually started winning. The more I practiced, the better my results and the more trophies I won. My confidence grew. Finally, it was nice to be known for my triumphs and not my troubles. Twirling eventually led me into the world of pageants. Someone gave me an application for one while I was at a twirling competition and explained that twirling could be my talent. Twirling competitions also have a pageantry element already intertwined, complete with gowns and interview, so I was already used to that. I gave it a try. I don't even think I placed in my first pageant, but I kept going. I'd gotten a taste of what it was like to win, and I wanted to see how far I could go. That time, Purpose tried to speak up. I eventually won a few preteen pageants here and there. Pageants get a bad rap, but learning how to carry yourself on stage, communicate with confidence and charisma, and perfect and perform a talent is no small undertaking. I enjoyed competition, but what I really loved was the opportunity to make a difference in the lives of others. As a title holder, that's what they call you when you win a crown, I was able to travel to different schools, conferences, fairs, nursing homes, and rodeos. Yes, you heard that right. Even hospitals. Every kind of event you can imagine. When I visited elementary schools and daycare centers, I'd read a short story from an illustrated children's book about the importance of having confidence and a positive attitude. There is nothing more adorable and exciting than seeing a room full of kindergartners hanging on your every word. And nothing more disappointing than having to tell them that, no, those aren't real diamonds in the crown. When I turned 13, a dear Italian woman named Benna helped me to get ready for the Miss Teen Texas competition. She had been around pageants longer than I had been alive, and she was the woman who first taught me how to properly Texas tease my hair. I was in a salon chair when Benna explained I needed to choose an official platform for the competition. A platform is basically an issue or cause you are passionate about championing as a part of your service to the community. I immediately knew what I wanted to concentrate my advocacy efforts on. I'd like to focus on building self-esteem, I said. Benna looked concerned. A little wrinkle formed in her forehead, and she said, "It's not a real platform, honey. Self-esteem is nice and important, but it's not a real social issue. You need to pick a cause that has more meat to it, something like cancer, AIDS, adoption, or crime." I listened to her, politely nodded, and I soaked up her advice like a sponge. I always appreciated when adults were willing to shoot straight and share wisdom with me. It's better than being brushed off, and I'm just wired to learn. She went on to explain that fluffy topics like self-esteem weren't taken very seriously. Now, I didn't know exactly why I wanted to focus on building self-esteem. I just knew. I wrestled with self-doubt, largely due to feeling left out and overlooked at school. Believing in yourself was the topic of the children's books I instinctively picked out and read when speaking at elementary schools. And this is what the books I picked out for myself were about, too. Odd, I know, for a teenager to be reading self-help and personal development books, but I did. Inside, I took a deep breath. You know, the one where you're thinking, where do I go from here? I loved sharing the power of positive thinking with audiences. I had come up with all of these activities for kids and had figured out how to adjust my talk for adult audiences, too. I have to really think about what else would work that would also tap into my passion. It took me another year or so to figure it out. My focus came together as I started getting involved as a volunteer and student leader with youth violence, crime, and drug prevention initiatives while in high school. The first big project I worked on was a campaign with the State Bar of Texas called Stop the Violence. I remember it well. Thankfully, I didn't have to deal with the fear of dodging bullets and gang warfare every day. I grew up in a beautiful neighborhood in the suburbs of Dallas. But for some reason, I was drawn to help others whose circumstances were dramatically different than mine. I had this deep appreciation for the blessings I did have, and I felt compelled to do what I could for other young people who didn't have the same opportunities as me. So youth crime prevention through leadership development became my platform. I knew better than to use the phrase self-esteem in the title, so I ended up incorporating the phrase leadership development instead. That one seemed to work. I had found the right words and the right lane, one impressive enough and therefore good enough. What is the right lane? The right lane is the paved path. It's the acceptable, right way of doing things. And going down it leads to an approved life, one that is socially desirable, stable, and viewed as successful. The right lane has an insanely strong pull, so strong that it's the path most people, not just women, travel. After all, it's easier and less intimidating to walk down a road that's already been paved, especially in high hills. And because well-meaning friends, family, and mentors who want the best for us don't want us wandering off on a dark road all alone, they steer us as best they can onto what seems like the best or right way, the path least likely to cause us pain, even if it's crowded. That's what Miss Venna was trying to do in steering me toward a more proper platform. She wanted me to have the best chance of winning and help me find the most predictable path that would get me there. This is not necessarily a bad thing, but the talent stage is where we're taught how to pick and stick to a lane. We choose who we're going to be and what we'll work towards becoming. The question is, are we equipped to pick a path aligned with our destiny? It's hard to pick a path you don't even know exists. And it's incredibly unlikely you'll pick a path that you don't believe you belong in or deserve. Settling versus maturing. The decision to choose the right lane at 14 years old later turned out to be an incredibly influential choice. It shaped the focus of my life, my decisions, my schooling, my goals, my time, and my spirit for the next 11 years. I went all the way in. I spoke about youth empowerment and investing in young people, sometimes 60 to 70 times a year. I ended up majoring in political science and criminal justice and then went to law school with the intention of becoming a juvenile court judge and one day Attorney General of the United States. Being an advocate no longer had anything to do with pageants. That's just what got me in the game, so to speak. But it was passion and conviction that kept me in it for over a decade. I co-founded a federally funded organization called the National Youth Network at 16, and went on to spend much of my time lobbying legislators, speaking at Department of Justice conferences, and organizing youth empowerment events in conjunction with local police departments around the country. Then Governor, later President, George W. Bush appointed me to the Texas State Advisory Group at the age of 19. My job was to consult on juvenile crime issues and the U.S. Justice Department's Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention later blessed me with the Strengthening the Voice of Youth Across America Award. All this time, I was still training as a competitive baton twirler, going to school, getting straight A's, and applying for and winning awards and scholarships, all while making 70-plus motivational speeches a year. Why am I telling you this? I often think back to that salon chair moment. What would happen if I had just stood firm in my desire to choose self-esteem as my platform? Would I have racked up frequent flyer miles in my teens? Would I have traveled the world and fast-tracked my leadership acumen at such an early age? Would I have met and worked with then U.S. Attorney General, the late Janet Reno, and other world leaders? Would my poli-sci and criminal justice major in college have been different? And would I have even gone to law school? I don't know. I'll never know for sure. This I do know. Purpose made itself known very early. The desire to focus on self-esteem back then, right in that salon chair, foreshadowed my commitment to encourage you to believe bigger now. It started first with that lightning bolt moment where I vowed to be a belief-elevating teacher. My point is that it's who I've always been. Even if we don't always see or understand God's hand in the moment, or we miss the clues about how He's pre-wired us to impact others, divine providence is always working. God clearly planned for me to become a baton twirler. He didn't just plan it. He put me smack in the center of it. I was literally surrounded by it. Not just at the daycare, but my first two coaches lived on opposite ends of the same street where I'd grown up. How crazy is that, that these two women lived just a few feet away? They had been there all along, well before I was born, and before my parents picked our yellow brick home. Think about how God has pre-wired you, your personality, and your natural interests, too. God most certainly placed early purpose clues and destiny developers in your life, too. Can you think about what they were and what impact they had on you? To be clear, my life purpose was not baton twirling. That's a skill. I happen to be more natural or gifted at it than most. However, purpose is more about your personality and how you show up in a way that improves the lives of others. It's about your natural impact. And as you'll discover, purpose is also about a larger message that your life is meant to convey. However, baton twirling was a maturity mechanism and skill builder on the path to higher purpose for me. It certainly gave me discipline and dedication. God knows exactly what He is doing and places us in certain environments for a reason. Didn't always understand the lack of diversity in my neighborhood or at my school. But perhaps God wanted me to develop resilience, self-motivation, and drive. And maybe He put me right where I needed to be to uncover a hidden talent. I had no idea when I picked up that baton in daycare that being able to twirl would take me 15 years later to the Miss America competition, winning talent, interview, and $80,000 in scholarships. That faith journey is another story for another day. As is made clear in Romans chapter 8, verse 28, we have to remember that all things work for good when we're called according to fulfilling God's purpose. In hindsight, I have absolutely no regrets about following Miss Benna's advice. I have every confidence the path I took was indeed the one God intended for me to travel, because His fingerprints are all over doors only He could have opened. For a young brown girl living in the South, labeled a problem child, the granddaughter of housekeepers and the descendant of sharecroppers, to have ended up where I was, yes, God was all up in it. And yet, this was my first experience of trading passion for approval. It's the first time I can recall that I picked what society and the powers that be told me would be the right lane. It was a mixed bag, nothing to be ashamed of, but more so something to be aware of. Much of activating our true calling is about awareness anyway. The key takeaway here is that purpose showed itself early in my life. It had been there all along. The topic of thinking bigger, growing confidence, and believing in yourself flows through my veins. It always has. Even though I didn't know it, self-esteem building was always my mission. We can't change who we are. We can hide out, But our divine purpose and natural inclination to impact others is always with us. We can't pick it. God places it in us and it manifests unconsciously. During those early years of doing juvenile advocacy work, I was really helping young people find their core possibility, positivity, and self-esteem, and encouraging them to believe beyond their circumstances. Back then, I was doing it by speaking to kids in gangs and juvenile prisons. Now I'm blessed to speak in front of millions. It's the same message, just a different format. The same holds true for you. Your ultimate mission, your purpose, your thing, it has always been there too. Natural purpose isn't something we have to work hard for. It just flows. We can't help it, but over time we can learn to harness it. The obstacles you faced are really about the obstacles you're assigned to. Looking back, I'd say God and maybe Miss Benna knew that those kids needed my message the most back then, and that's why it was channeled in that way. But my purpose was always there. What about you? What purpose clues showed up in and around you? The best way to look for clues about this is by going back in time. Think for a moment about the early, pure dreams and desires you had as a kid. The stuff you wanted to do before others told you who you needed to be, or to focus on something more practical, stable, and acceptable. Was it singing? Was it drawing or dance? Was it being an astronaut, a fighter pilot, sewing, designing, or playing an instrument? Maybe a TV host, an engineer, or the best mother on the planet? What was it? God places early desires in us that most reflect His desires for us. Those desires know no limitations until someone talks us out of pursuing them. So what is something you've always naturally done? Is it encouraging others? Is it strategizing, creating, or crafting? Is it organizing, mentoring, coaching, and teaching? Conversely, what is something you always wanted to do but never had a chance or the courage to do or explore? What problems did you want to solve? What difference have you always wanted to make? Why do you think that initial desire was there? Just take a moment and do an inner assessment of the things you've always done, things you've always loved, and things that have always come naturally to you. Also think about things you didn't do, or ideas or interests the rules talked you out of pursuing. This exercise isn't about nostalgia or rehashing a painful season of life. It's certainly not about blame or regret. That comes from little me. Refuse to allow stinkin' thinkin' to hijack this moment. Reflection is an invitation. Remember, God speaks to us from the future to invite us into untapped promise and provision. It's about hearing God's whisper for what He wants you to know about His master plan for you now. I know without a doubt that purpose has often raised her voice and made appearances in your life, too. Chapter 7, Masquerading and Mountain Climbing. Thursday Nights. I picked my career path early. I was sitting in front of a 200-pound box, waffle-wrapped in yellow wicker, with a screen tough enough to withstand karate kicks and flying soccer balls. We called it a television, but it was more like an elephant with knobs. It was bigger than me and probably heavier than me, my brother, and my mama combined, but right now it had my full attention. Thursday night was when the entire family gathered round to watch The Cosby Show. As you know, I grew up in a predominantly white neighborhood and went to what was essentially an all-white school. When I picked up a magazine or turned on that yellow elephant, every woman I saw in television commercials was also white. When I did see someone who looked like me on television, a woman who God had also chosen to wrap in brown skin, she was always serving someone who didn't have brown skin or she was struggling. But not on Thursday nights. On Thursday nights, I saw teenagers that looked like me and my brother. I saw the only woman who was half as beautiful as my mother, Claire Huxtable. She was a lawyer, married to a doctor, and she was the epitome of a supermom. She had a successful career, a thriving family, a beautiful house, a charming yet no-nonsense personality, and a husband who drooled all over her. And her brown skin looked just like mine. During one episode in particular, I watched her walk through the front door of their expensive brownstone in New York City with poise and briefcase in tow. Her hair was perfectly layered, and somehow, at the end of a very long workday, she looked happy and refreshed, fully ready to shift from superwoman to supermom. That's when I decided who I would become. I would become a lawyer, too. I had never seen or even heard of a black female attorney. I didn't actually meet one until I was nearly 21 years old. But Mrs. Huxtable looked important, polished, and admired. I knew then that I, too, wanted to be seen, significant, and successful. Thursday nights gave me something to look forward to. That show gave me a chance to dream, and I took it. Seeing Mrs. Huxtable, I didn't want to be that problem child anymore. Now I knew what I wanted to be. I just need someone who would give me a push to become it. Desktop wax and smacks. Let's back up just a few years. Yes, we're going back to elementary school one more time. In fifth grade, Mr. Eager was my homeroom teacher. He was a tall, slender man with dark brown hair and a pointy nose. Very funny. Fair as well, but also no nonsense. He walked around the classroom with a yardstick and would smack it on your desk if you were talking or not following class rules. However, on this day, I didn't even get the pleasure of a desktop smack. I probably had said something smart alecky in front of the class and pushed one of his buttons. I don't remember exactly what I said, but I do remember that his face turned redder than I thought humanly possible, and he told me to meet him in the hallway. "Why do you act like this?" he said. "You can be so much more than you think you can. You just have to start believing you can." And there it was, my sign, my big aha, that lightning bolt moment. This was the first time in my life that I could recall someone other than my parents specifically telling me that I mattered, that I had a worthy future and opportunities beyond my past and present experiences. And it was a school teacher at that. Coach Janice, Miss Benna, and Claire Huxtable, sure, they inspired me, but they didn't really know problem child me. Mr. Eager did, but he didn't seem to look down on me like the other teachers. He had transferred in just a few months prior, and this was his first year at the school. I will never forget that hallway moment of awakening. It was as if someone splashed cold water on my face, waking me from a trance. It shook my spirit and my size 6 shoes to the core. I was used to seeing angry adults glare at me with disdain. However, as I looked at Mr. Eager, I only saw the eyes of love and of God looking right back at me. Success conditioning. That hallway chat was more than just a chat. It was a catalyst conversation. This is when I started working hard in school. I was going to show those know-it-all adults who said I needed to be in special education classes. I went from having good grades to having great grades. I started winning academic awards and then started excelling in both school and leadership activities. When I brought home my report card, it no longer had problems listed, only praise. My dad, he'd give me $20 for each A and $10 for each B. He was actually the first person to invest in me. So now I had double incentive to stay focused, to get better, and to succeed. A good showing would either mean applause or at least a sweet payday. Eventually, I became hooked. I finally found a way to fit in. I found a reason to be liked. And I found a path that would at least give me a shot to prove that I was worthy, that I mattered and had something to offer. I was smitten with success. Achievement became my drug, and it was the type of habit everyone around me encouraged me to continue. People love to be around achievement. So just as I was saying goodbye to low self-esteem, my battle with success addiction began. I became an overachiever, a $200,000 scholarship getter who lived on the honor roll. I graduated college magna cum laude and went to one of the best law schools in the world. I was a long way from being that problem child now, and I liked it that way. Actually, I loved it that way. Voted most likely to succeed in high school. Take that, haters. I was on my way to becoming a high-powered lawyer, a real-life Claire Huxtable, who was getting to make a real difference in the lives of young people who were less fortunate than me. Helping others became my obsession. There is sometimes a thin line between service and success. A passion, it was sincere, but it was also another form of accomplishing and striving. In retrospect, I see that everything I did was obsessive. In truth, I was just scared to death of failure, rejection, and being invisible. Inspired by Claire Huxtable and one teacher's comments, I had picked my lane, success by any means necessary. So tell me, what's your lane? Do you remember when you picked it? Lanes, drugs, and mountains. Oh my. Once an addict, always an addict. Well, that's what they say. I kind of know what they mean. Over time, God helped to wean me off the achievement drug and the need to feel important, but the urge never really goes away. Keep in mind, I have had Christ at the center of my life since I was a toddler. Believing in God and loving God doesn't automatically mean that your life is perfect. Don't let others sell you that bag of lies. Spiritual growth comes from perspective. As an adult, I can see now that much of what I did was in response to me clinging to the rules and running from the little me whispers of insignificance and self-doubt. I'm not sure I wanted to be successful. I just didn't want to be alone. I certainly didn't want to be invisible. My escape was achievement. I mastered the art of looking impressive. I figured out how to get people to like me, pay attention to me, and applaud me. I never used drugs. That would have been against the rules. But achievement was just as addictive. Today in my life work as a mentor, strategist, and spiritual teacher, I find that every woman on the planet has a drug. That includes you, sweet friend. The question is, what is your drug of choice? Your drug is something you've come to cling to. We all have an addiction to something, an underlying need to showcase and validate our worth, to be needed, and to prove our relevance. None of us as women are exempt. You may not be willing to admit it just yet. That's okay. I didn't like being called an addict either. It's cool. Just stay with me. Most women I know tend to strive or define themselves in one of five areas. I call them the five success mountains, not to be confused with the five stages of reinvention we're unpacking. Each mountain simply represents a goal, responsibility, or lane that we choose to live in that gives us meaning, focus, and a sense of identity. Understanding what type of mountain climber you have been and what hidden addiction has led you up it, what you're really running from, is key to discovering where God is trying to lead you next. So let's dive into them. Mountain number one, marriage. The marriage mountain is one that we're taught to climb as little girls adorned with dolls and fairy tales. We are programmed to search for Prince Charming. Being pretty becomes a priority, and we soon learn that's also who and what Prince Charming really wants. On the marriage mountain, we find our identity and sufficiency in being a wife and having what we believe to be a successful marriage that others admire and want to emulate. Mountain number two, motherhood. The motherhood mountain is where our identity is attached to our children. Even if you don't have children, you might believe that part of fulfilling your calling as a woman means having children and being celebrated for it. Oh, how addicting this one can be. I loved being a bonus mom. It was something I had always wanted, so badly that it created blind spots that kept me from seeing that infidelity was all around me. Mountain number three, money. The money mountain is defined by work, career, and building a professional legacy. On this mountain, we find our value and our worth in our work, in the titles we earn, the checks we make, the suits we wear, the offices we hold, the awards we win, the perceived impact we have, and how impressive we look. Mountain number four, mending. The mending mountain is tied to our inner misfixer. It's the reason we end up trying to be all things to all people. We find validation in being able to help others solve their problems, being reliable and dependable. And we also find our value in sacrificing ourselves for others for the sake of saving them. It feels good to come to the rescue and to be a perceived master at holding it all together. It makes us as women feel useful, needed, and relevant. Mountain number five, making a difference. Giving is godly, but when our core identity gets defined by the act of serving and sacrificing, giving is no different than greed. Though our efforts seem noble, truly we want something in exchange. We want praise. We want validation. Underneath the service, there is ultimately a burning desire to satisfy a void by being seen as a servant. So those are our five mountains. You may identify with one mountain in particular, or maybe more than one. I have always gravitated towards the money, mending, and making a different mountains, in that order. Those tend to give me my fix, so to speak. I was not really sure that I'd have what it took to become a mother or selected as a wife, so I inclined towards the ones that I knew I could control, the ones that didn't rely upon other people. Hey, it does feel really good to feel like you can fix other people. We just have to be conscious of the temptation to try to be something for ourselves or for others that really is just our addiction in action, an attempt to feel important and worthy. So which mountain do you gravitate to? Is it the marriage mountain, the motherhood mountain, the money mountain, the mending mountain, or the making a difference mountain? And depending on which one speaks most to you, how has it defined who you are, or how has it possibly even confined who you've not become? As women, we don't just want to be on the mountain. We want to look like we've mastered it. So we keep climbing, fitting in, and doing whatever it takes to get to the top. That's what happens in the talent stage. You become good at what you do until what you do eventually defines who you are. But look, the mountains aren't the problem. It's how we climb them. Success isn't solely about accolades. It's about appearances, how we want to come across to others, and it's about whatever we believe validates our identity. The things that we're climbing toward on those mountains often have very little to do with our anointing and our master purpose, but we're too focused on our goal to see it. If you think you're a struggling artist and God is telling you that you're a wealthy engineer, that's going to seem crazy. If you think you're just a mom, so to speak, you might miss that God is calling you to be a media mogul, an international speaker, a creative entrepreneur, or a multimillionaire. You end up ignoring the call, the signs, and God's will for your life. We can miss who we're called to be because we're addicted and attached to who we've decided to be. When the bigger vision doesn't make sense, we tend to look the other way. Don't get me wrong. Each mountain is a divine gift, and God loves to give us the desires of our heart. In fact, I believe each mountain represents a desire God placed in us for a reason. Mountains give us an opportunity to impact others, develop our potential, and find our way. There is tremendous purpose in each lane, but each lane still has its limits. Limit number one, first of all, attaining success on any of the five mountains is contingent upon other people. I don't believe that God intends for our core identity to be attached to or predicated upon anyone else but God. Look at Mary. She's known for motherhood, the immaculate conception, and giving birth to Christ. But in essence, she was really just a woman on an intimate faith journey with God, where the two of them conspired to do the unthinkable and birth the impossible. That's who Mary was. That's who Mary is, a faith walker, an unleasher. Limit number two. Second, what do you do when disruption strikes, when that marriage fails, the kids grow up, the job or the paycheck ends, your advice is no longer needed, or those you serve take you for granted? If Mary's whole life was only about being a vessel for the birth of Christ, which was her mission, what was she to do when Christ grew up? Did her life cease to matter? Was it time for her to retire and live the rest of her life going down memory lane? Absolutely not. God calls us to reinvention, not retirement. Being a mother and a wife is a blessing and a divine opportunity. But if you don't get married and don't have children, you still have an incredible core purpose that is larger than any one title. Being able to help others improve their lives, to serve and to do work that matters or earns a living is also a blessing. However, it may have nothing to do with where God needs you next. Now, most of us suffer from what I call RVSD, Random Vision Selection Disorder. Yeah, yes, I made that up. But we don't necessarily pick our path because it's what we're called to do. We pick it because it was available, attainable, and seeable. When you don't have a clear vision, any vision will do. So we pick a lane and we make it our life based off of one of the following reasons. We choose it because of proficiency. We're good at it. Maybe we pick it because of passion. We love it. Because of praise, meaning we're celebrated for it. Perhaps because of pay. We can simply make a living at it. Oftentimes we select it because of pressure. We felt like we just had to do it. Or good old-fashioned protocol. We're supposed to do it. That's all good, but notice very few of us pick our present path because of purpose, what we're called to do by God. We don't know how. Development versus destination. Ultimately, your talents are the sum total of what you've learned to do via exposure, training, and practice. They are those skills and abilities that with time, training, and practice, you turn into proficiencies. Naturally, there are some things you do better than others, and so often the things we focused on the most become the talents that define the scope of our beliefs and dreams. We not only bypass our purpose, we never see it coming. The talent stage, where we master a path, develop proficiency, and adopt a chosen identity, is a necessary part of our divine development, but it's not the final destination. Sure, our talents are areas of strength, and strengths, they make us feel safe, capable, competent, which we love, and secure. But your talents are not the final destination. God is not confined by your career or your choices, but he is obsessed with ushering you into his calling. Most women and men live their entire life in the talent stage. They retire here and die here. Let's not be counted in that number. Let's not leave behind untapped potential and untapped purpose. Purpose goes beyond a career path. It goes wherever God flows. That's where and who we want to be, wherever God is. The talent stage can be comfortable. It's where you do what you're good at. In this stage of my life, I went all the way from lilac Coke bottle glasses to the Miss America stage, one of the top law firms in the world, to appearing regularly on television and starting my own professional sports agency. But the drug of success is dangerous too. When you're caught up in whatever you've chosen to do, there's rarely quiet. There's rarely time to think about what you're doing. The noise feels natural. Silence can be frightening, and it's intimidating. But that's when you ask yourself, who am I really? Who do I really want to be? Who is the woman that I will no longer allow myself to be? When you start to ask these questions, that's when you start to move beyond the talent stage. The talent stage is supposed to be merely a season of your life, not the whole shebang. If we're really serious about following God and discovering the unlived life heaven has for us, then we've got to become comfortable with disruption, with letting God take us beyond predictability and titles that can become idols, to a place where we enter our purpose and our assignment. Change is God's specialty, and interruption is God's area of mastery. Before we move on, I believe it'll be very valuable and helpful for us to purposefully uncover and take stock of your talents, your skills, abilities, and achievements, and what you're good at. So think about it. What are your talents? What have you learned to do really well? What impact have you made at home, in your community, in the lives of others, and in your career and on your journey thus far? What are the things that you enjoy doing? Now, don't be shy about answering these questions. God wants us to look at our talents with a healthy sense of accomplishment and gratification, just as God looked proudly upon his work after creating the world. However, our true identity is attached to God's divinity, not activity. The talent stage can be dangerously task-driven, urging us to contribute to society in a useful and socially productive way. Talents may be our beginning, but they are not supposed to be our ending. As we will soon discover, gifts, on the other hand, guide us into a dimension far greater than where talent can ever take us. Gifts are not task-driven. They're testimony-driven, designed to unleash the glory and goodness of God in us, through us, and around us. So, my beautiful friend, here's the conclusion. Here's what I, a recovering success addict, now believe in my heart of hearts to be undeniably true. The skillfully manufactured faux significance we found through goal slaying, mountain climbing, and identity creating can never, ever satisfy us or fully glorify God. For that, we need to allow God to lead us out of the talent stage and into what I like to call the gap. Tapping into the God-made, purpose-soaked future awaiting you is the only real path to fulfillment. So let's enter it, shall we? Chapter 8, Stage 3, The Gap. What is happening to me? Embracing in between. The big mission inside of you is seeking expression. When God calls you to something that's not on your radar, embrace it. As you know now, the purpose journey begins in the discovery stage, where we're bathed in the rules, and later we make decisions about what kind of life we're going to pursue in the talent stage. But after a while, many of us start feeling uncomfortable there. Our inner rebel gets tired of the old, bored with the predictable, and unsatisfied with the superficial. We're ready to relinquish our identity addictions. That's when the really good and scary stuff begins. When we're done, God gets started. Heaven unleashes its holy arsenal and uses everything at its disposal to move us from our comfort zone into the growth zone. Or is it a war zone? Probably both. Little me isn't going to let your higher purpose unfold without a fight. As uncomfortable, familiar, and maybe even exhausting as the discovery and talent stages are, they can't compare with the more fulfilling life that awaits. But what is that exactly? We feel something greater in the future calling to us. It tugs at our soul and agitates our spirit, but we can't quite see the bigger picture, and we're not 100% sure we want to either. What was once stable is now shaky. People you trusted are now letting you down, deeply. Your job suddenly ends. Your kids go off to college. You lose a loved one, or something unexpected intrudes upon your plans and your dreams. Your life somehow gets flipped upside down, and you ask, who am I now and why am I feeling this way? Where do these tears and this newfound fear come from? Why is everything changing around me, everything I worked so hard to establish? What does all this mean? What do I do now and where in the heck am I going? What is happening to me? You see, God must be trying to get your attention. And now you find yourself in a peculiar place. A wilderness, a place of transition, a place in between where you've been and who you're called to be. That place is probably extremely uncomfortable because you're no longer in control. Welcome to stage 3 of the purpose map. Welcome to the gap. The gap. I don't like change. I never have. I love predictability and I love a good plan to follow. Give me a checklist and a strategy and I'll give you results that will wow you. I doubt I'm the only one who wrestles with God for the steering wheel. I want him to drive, but I still secretly want to know what he's doing, where he's going, and how he plans on us getting there. But then disruption comes in and changes everything. It disturbs our attachment to predictability and anything that has too much of our heart and attention. God is actually trying to get us to shift, and here's why. God won't bless where you no longer belong. It's the principle of here versus there. God can't bless you here with what he has for you there. If he gave you your there blessing, you'd never move from here. You'd stay. So sometimes the reason God seems like he isn't answering your prayers is that the provision doesn't fit with where you are. God isn't being mean. He's being a parent. You'll never learn how to walk unless you take forward steps. If you're always carried or if everything comes to you, then you never find your legs. You never learn what it takes to get up from where you are to get to where you should be. God isn't holding a blessing hostage. He has just put it there. There is smack in the center of the place he wants to get you to. However, the place in between your here and there is the gap. It's that obscure place of transition. It's when you know it's time to leave where you've been, but you're not completely sure where you're going. Sometimes we choose to enter the gap. Desire leads us to do something new and different. Sometimes we get frustrated into it. We can no longer stand our circumstances and we just know it's time for a change. And other times we get split-rocked into it. But this in-between place of uncertainty isn't supposed to be permanent. And it's not supposed to be punishment, although it can seem like it. Being in the gap is like moving from the womb to the birth canal. At a certain point, the womb gets too small and it's time to move on. You can't stay in the incubator forever, but the canal is tight, dark, and uncomfortable. You're being pushed, pulled, squeezed, and poked all at the same time. Naturally, you wonder why in the world your mother is doing this to you. Everything was going just fine before, but this transition is necessary for your new season to begin. New experiences, new possibilities, and ample room for growth. Danger is staying where you've been. It stunts your growth and limits your future. If you stay, the womb becomes a tomb. The best is on the other side of birth. There's a reason babies come out crying. They're mad. They've not known anything other than the comfortable warmth of the womb. The unfamiliar is almost always unwanted, at least initially. And there is nothing sexy about birthing. Even deliveries without the intense pain aren't pretty. Beautiful, but not pretty. It's messy. Most things that matter are. But this is how the shift into higher purpose and a season of calling happens in our lives. And it might be what is happening to you now. You're being evicted from here and relocated to there. And just because a life shift is messy, that does not mean that it's not majestic, too. Why are you in the gap? If you're in the gap, it means you've outgrown your comfort zone. It does not mean that there's anything wrong with where you've been. You may have been very successful there, but we're not interested in mere success. We want a life soaked in significance. You may have been sensing that it's time for a change, though you may have been ignoring, delaying, procrastinating, or avoiding it. Maybe you haven't been able to decipher what the change should be, or maybe you've just been too busy to focus on it, to listen, to surrender, or to make room for more. You're not, and you will never be invisible to God. You are necessary for His master plan. So what are you hiding from exactly? Your calling. Your true calling. Your higher purpose. The gap is God's way of moving you from your comfort zone into your purpose. It's time to find your voice. It's time to discover your new possibilities, resurrect dormant dreams, and step into a new season of impact, influence, leadership, giving, love, and service. First, you'll have to unload a few of the beliefs, people, and attachments you've been holding on to. This won't be easy, so take a deep breath. Now take another if you need it. You're in the gap because you're somehow unsatisfied with where you've been. Not necessarily unhappy, but you're hungry for more. You are no longer content with where you've been and with what you've accomplished, and God needs you in a new place. Let me pause to say that discontent too is a mixed bag. If we're unsatisfied because we're never satisfied, then that's a different thing. That's a chasing after the wind, a search for meaning found in doing. As a seasoned striver and achiever, I know that breed of discontentment very well. It's rooted in trying to prove worth and significance. Embracing significance, however, is very different. It's surrendering to truth. The truth is, you are already fearfully and wonderfully made, beautifully complex, permanently loved by God, and necessary to Him and therefore humanity. There is nothing for you to prove. Disruption comes to replace discontent with destiny, to draw us into a deeper dimension of living, giving, and flowing. There is, however, something bigger for you to unleash. When destiny begins to brew and bubble in your belly, it's time to get ready for a new kind of delivery. That's a healthy discontent, the sign of a healthy supernatural pregnancy. I know many of us have been told that there are only some people who are called to lead, and that the rest of us need to grow where we're planted. Not so. While it's true that grounding yourself is key for development, the question is, what are you being developed for? I mean, why grow your faith anyway? Are we supposed to be trees planted in one place? Or are we supposed to be fishers of men like Christ to get out of the boat? The gap is about finding the courage to take that step. After all, we're more like eggs than seeds. Both grow, but only one can move. The only way to move into your purpose is to travel through the gap. The gap is also about gaining an appreciation for your gifts and your voice, Learning to tap into the good stuff God gave you and to actually start flowing in it, not just having drive-by experiences with your God giftings. The gap is like a classroom that teaches you to live at a higher level and in a higher frequency, one capable of attracting what you need and accelerating who you truly are. On the other side of the gap, you'll learn to activate your voice, gifts, and influence. But this time is about paying attention, unlearning, and discerning